University of Colorado.
Thanks for tuning in to See You on the Air, the podcast of the University of Colorado.
If I was writing a movie script, I don't think I could have written one that was more the American story than George Norland. He really believed that every single person on campus was equal.
We're talking today with Dr. Paul Chinowski, who is an engineering professor moving toward environmental design, but who has a special interest in one of the giants of the University of Colorado, its longest-serving president, George Norland. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here and glad to talk about George Norland.
Well, some people seem to loom particularly large in the life of an institution, and George Norland was certainly that with the University of Colorado. Simple but complex question. Why is that?
Well, he had an extremely long tenure as president. He was president of the university for 30 years, and he was president in one of the most dynamic times. He saw the population of the university triple. He was here when we really changed from this almost regional university to an international player. And the events that he oversaw involved with civil rights, involved with the early parts of international conflict. And so more than anybody else, he probably put his fingerprint on the university in a way that's not only lasted, but we can go back and say, wow, there's so much of what he said that still resonates today. And that's really why he was so important, pivotal figure.
He was a complex man in many ways, and we'll drill down into some of that. Talk about his early life. He had a somewhat adventurous early life that shaped him.
He did. It's interesting. If I was writing a movie script, I don't think I could have written one that was more the American story than George Norland. He was born literally in a sod house on the prairie in Kansas. His parents were Swedish immigrants. Today we would say they lost everything in a bad real estate deal, but they came out and started over. He was there with his brothers, seven kids. They survived an Indian attack by crawling into a hollow log. His father decided that Concordia, Kansas got too many people and they moved to Green Bay, Wisconsin. He grew up fishing, outdoorsman. His mother died when he was young. And very unusually, he kept with school for that time, went to high school and on to college in Nebraska. So his life was truly an American story, and one that, like I said, if I was writing a story, I don't think I could have written it any better.
Talk a little bit about his academic background and interest.
Yeah, when he was in high school, he was in class and he was reading history. And he came upon some examples of Greek writing and some hieroglyphics as they were studying Egypt. He asked his teacher about it and was really interested in what they were looking at. His teacher couldn't tell him a whole lot. But it started this spark inside of him that he really wanted to know, what was this? What were ancient civilizations about? And that started his love of classics. He was offered a fellowship to the University of Chicago to do his PhD work, a very prestigious fellowship, and became one of the foremost scholars of Greek at that time, went to Greece, really studied the Peloponnesian Wars. He really was interested in Athenians and the start of democracy and their fight internally in Greece, which really shaped a lot of what his thought was, is how great civilizations could be torn apart when discourse stopped and what we could learn from that.
And as a young man and scholar, he spent time in Germany and was quite alarmed early on about the Nazis well before the war. How did that experience shape him?
Yeah, actually, he had two experiences which were really important. During World War I, he was very concerned about how Germany was changing. Here he was going to school. He studied the Germans. He was taught that Germany was a modern great civilization. And he saw World War I really as a pivotal point in civilization about how here we are in modern times and a great civilization could fall apart, just like he witnessed in Greece. Later on in 1932, he had a fellowship to go to Germany, and he actually was staying in the same hotel in Germany as Adolf Hitler. And he was there in Berlin and watched the Nazis gain power. He watched as they went into Berlin University and told the professors that they couldn't teach history unless it was approved by the Nazi government. And to him, once again, he was filled with that real dread of how are we repeating the same thing? How was this great civilization being torn apart, and why isn't anybody paying attention to it? Interestingly enough, his wife was very active also while they were there, and she was writing also about the changing role of the German household. And he came back and tried to warn people, saying this was something that we should be really paying attention to. His famous quote was always, Adolf Hitler was not somebody he'd want to go fishing with. But
me neither.
Yeah. Well, now we look back and say, yeah, probably not. But no one really listened to him. And it was something that he considered one of the great regrets in his life. He felt like he really could have done something to at least prevent how bad the war got and how widespread. And he tried and actually got attacked by people who thought that he was a Nazi sympathizer, that he was taking their side, when really what he was doing was saying the German people went through a very rough time after World War I. He could see how things progressed, but it didn't have to get to that point, and that really we needed to pay attention and help them. Otherwise, we were going to face the consequences, that the rational view we were taking was not going to be the way it turned out.
Turned out he was quite prescient.
He was. Unfortunately, he lived just long enough to see what the results actually happened.
Wonder if he ever thought, I told you so.
I think there were a lot of times where he said in his life, I told you so. He was way ahead of his time on a lot of issues. And I think there were a lot of times he would have liked to have said, if you just listened to me, we could have avoided some of this.
Norlin was a Greek scholar, but one of his notable accomplishments had little to do with academics.
He was a Greek scholar. He translated well-known Greek texts. That's where he first came across. But what, interestingly enough, the first time we actually hear of him on a national stage is in 1914, he becomes the first commissioner of the Athletic Association in the Rocky Mountain region. And he did that because he was very concerned about the trend that semi-pro athletes were being used by universities to represent them. And as a scholar, that just, you know, that was not the correct way. He did believe very strongly in the Greek version of mind and body health. He loved the concept of the Olympics and all of these things. So he became commissioner of the Rocky Mountain region and wrote one of the first rules that a student must be in good standing to represent the university. And that was actually something that's held through all the way to today. And that, interestingly enough, here he was a Greek scholar, and the first time we really hear about him, athletics.
Again, he was ahead of his time.
He was ahead of his time, absolutely.
There were some unique circumstances that led to him being acting president and then president.
Yeah, in 1917, Livingston Ferrand, who was the president of the university, who was a doctor, was called to Europe to head the Tuberculosis Commission during World War I to try and figure out how they could contain that. He was appointed interim president or acting president while Livingston Ferrand was in Europe. President Farron never came back. He stayed. He became head of the Red Cross, and the faculty were asked to vote, and they voted unanimously to make George Norlin president in 1919. Last time the faculty ever voted unanimously on anything, but he was considered just a great person to be around, and the faculty loved him. He did great with the staff, and he really believed that every single person on campus was equal, and his door was open. He wanted to talk to them and work on this, and more than anything, if you would go fishing with him, he was perfectly happy to take as much time as you wanted to.
What do you attribute that success to?
Most of all, it's really about his treatment of others, that he believed absolutely that integrity was the key thing that anybody had, and that honesty and discourse was what it was. So whatever the problem was, he was open, he was honest, and he was going to sit down, even with people that vehemently disagreed with him, he was going to sit down and have a conversation with them. I think the other part was he was really a courageous leader. He was not afraid to stand up and say things that were unpopular. He was not afraid to stand up to politicians if he didn't think they were doing what was right for education and the students. So people really believed in him. When he was really one of those people who said, "This is my word, trust me," and people could trust him. He was going to follow up on it.
One of the most courageous things he did is what he's perhaps best known for, which is standing up to the KKK and the then governor who threatened the university. Talk about that episode.
Yeah, that was probably his most famous encounter, and the context of that really even makes it resonate even stronger. Back at that time, 1925, the state of Colorado was really controlled politically by the KKK. It was one of the largest areas where the KKK was. We had about 50,000 members in Colorado. It was not unusual in Boulder and other towns around here to have cross burnings on the weekend, to have large parades down the main streets with people in hoods. It was really a time when the KKK was strong. They controlled the governor's office. They were trying to get control of the state legislature. We were at a tipping point, and the governor basically said to George Norlin, "Either you get rid of all the Jews and Catholics on your staff, or we're going to take away your funding." And George Norlin said, "It is our job as a university to hire the people that we think are best to educate students." And he would not back down. And he said, "If you want to take away our funding, go ahead, but we're not going to clear the campus like this." And sure enough, the next year, 1925, that fiscal year, the state legislature withheld $125,000 from the university, which at the time was a huge part of the budget. George Norlin sat down with the faculty, with the staff. He said, "We're going to work together. We're going to tighten our belts. We're going to hold our budgets. We're not going to take raises. We're going to make cuts, and we're going to get through this because it's what's important for the students." And they did that. They held together, and the next year the budget came back, and it was actually one of the key points where the KKK lost really its control in Colorado. If there was nothing else that we remember about George Norlin, we can always go back and say, above all else, it was what was good for the university. And that's a message that we can all learn, keep in front of us today.
Absolutely. That's a powerful starting point, and I think that's exemplifies his strength of conviction that you were talking about. He obviously had a tremendous impact on the intellectual life of the university, but also had a significant impact on the physical campus.
He did. When he first became president in 1919, it was right at the time when the campus was going through a long-term planning of what it was going to be. And they brought in Day and Clotter. They were an architectural firm from Philadelphia who was brought in to do a long-term plan for the campus. And if you look at the plan from 1919, I always laugh because it was right when Mackey Auditorium was being built. And the original plan was we should look like that. The entire campus should be Gothic. It should look like a New England Ivy League campus. They were going to tear down Old Main. And the only thing that was going to be left from the original early buildings was Hale Science. Everything else was going to go, and we were going to look very much like a New England Ivy League campus. And George Norlin looked at that, and he worked with Clotter and said, I think we need something that reflects our Western heritage a little bit more. Coming from a classics background and having been to Italy and Greece, he was really enamored with the Italian countryside, and which came out of his work with the Romans and everything, and spent quite a bit of time there. So he and Clotter worked together, and Clotter really was fascinated with the shapes and the texture of the Flatirons. And so they looked at the sandstone and the colors and the textures, and we changed. And we came up with this Tuscan Italianate style, but really it was a Western adaptation of what they did in Italy. And that became the new style. And it's really interesting if for those people who have gone to the Tuscany region in Italy, you can take pictures of buildings there, bring them back here and overlay them, and you'll see the details in the windows and the doors look very, very similar, just a change in the stone that was used. Clotter created a style book that we follow today, details the stone, and what was really a key part of this is the texture on the walls of the buildings. So they're not smooth. They keep that very 3D effect, and that was to emulate some of the effect of the shadows on the mountains. If you look at the old buildings, all the old windows have a Indiana limestone, white limestone around them to offset against the sandstone that we had. So the look is really about what Clotter and Norlin saw of what a Western university really was. The other piece that was really important to them was the open courtyards and that the space that we had so you could be outside and enjoy the climate that we had. The other thing is the arches that we have all through the university. And it was really designed that everywhere you walked on the university, there would be a new vista, a new panorama that you could see. It was a new experience that you were going to have. And so even in small places between buildings, you have these little gateways that you have to experience something new. So the feel of it was very much there. And then also the expansion. We went through Helms and that whole part of the humanities grew so that we started to build towards the south. We also started to build out economics was what's now economics, what was originally the student union building. So we really saw our first big expansion. And part of that was really the growth in the student population. When George Norlin took over, we had about 1,500 students here. They literally could all fit in Mackey Auditorium. The entire university could sit in Mackey and he could talk to them. By the time it was done, we had 4,500 students here. We were a real regional university, and he saw that grow. He also saw a really big growth in the disciplines, engineering, the sciences. The specialization began to come in, and he saw that there was going to be a change. Where the traditional university was not necessarily the way it was going to be in the future. We were going to be a part of industrialization.
And that concerned him.
It did. He used to use the phrase that they were uneducated specialists. And it wasn't meant to be derogatory in that they didn't know what they were doing, but he came from a background, the late 1800s background of a scholar, really had a broad context. And he had a hard time dealing with, if I was an expert in one very narrow area, how did I relate that to the general public? How did I know what the impact of that was going to be? He was also concerned that we were bringing in faculty that were very narrow. They were very educated in their field, but he sort of lamented the generalist that was the classic professor that could tie together history and science. And he wrote a whole essay about where are we going to find the future teachers and where are they going to come from? Where are we going to value these people? So while he knew that specialization was the future, he oversaw the university split into a lot of different departments. There was a part of him that was saying, I'm not sure this is the right way to go.
Again, perhaps he was ahead of his time because we're seeing echoes of that very thing today.
We are. We could look at his writings today and put those on people that are in power today and would say, it's the same thing. It's the argument over what is the role of the university? Are we training people for a job? Is that the only thing we're doing? Are we educating broadly? The same argument that he faced with the political climate we face today. And there's not necessarily a right or wrong answer to it, but it is a debate that we could put into play at any time.
He obviously had a long tenure as president. We talked about his standing up to the Klan, but what were some of the other notable things about his presidency?
One of his big, what I would say, achievements that he had was the way he brought people together. He had a different focus on how we govern the university, how we brought students into play. He was a big advocate on student government. He thought the students, this was as much their university as the faculty's, and so he supported that. He also was a very big advocate of civil rights. While we don't necessarily always hear the stories of George Norland and civil rights, he was there fighting for the rights of all students to come in. He was very concerned about some of the racial boundaries that existed in the 20s, and he put together a commission to help break down those barriers here. He thought there was discrimination. He wanted to get rid of that as much as possible. So in the background, he laid the groundwork for reinforcing that this university would be open to everyone. And I think if we look at what are the unsung things that George Norland left for us, it was really reinforcing that this was a university that was for anybody to come to. And whether it was civil rights, whether it was access by in-state students, which was a big issue back then. We dealt with budget issues all through the whole history of the university, and he was adamant that this was not going to be a university that was dominated by out-of-state students that could spend a lot of money. There had to be balance. So it was really his conviction that this university really reflected the state of Colorado. That's an achievement that we just can't forget.
Institutions like universities sometimes take on the personality of the people who pass through. How does the personality of the University of Colorado reflect George Norland?
Well, I think that if George Norland were here today, I think there were a couple of things that we'd see. One, he would love to see everyone out on Norland Quad and Farron Field. He was an outdoorsman, and one of his trademarks was he had two Airedales that he would bring to class with him in the afternoon, and they would sleep underneath his desk, but they had a capacity to stay there about an hour and a half, and they would wake up and basically tell him it's time to go. He was notorious for not paying attention to the clock, and his classes never ended on time, and he would just continue to work with students as long as they wanted to be there. So his dog served as an alarm clock for him. So he would love
to see, valuable function.
Valuable function. So he would love to see how people were outside. The other part that I think reflects his personality is people come here because they love the lifestyle. He was instrumental in starting something that was called the Professor's Ranch, which was a area up near Lyons where a group of faculty and staff bought property up there and they built cabins and they would go fishing. And he would take colleagues up there. He spent every summer up there. When we talk about the Boulder lifestyle, we talk about people in the outdoors, he would be out there saying, yes, this is a critical part of being here. And you come here as much for living in the shadow of the Flatirons and getting out and being outside. And I think we see that with the faculty, the students, and the staff that are here today. It's as much about Colorado and Boulder as it was in 1930.
What do you think would dismay them about today's university?
I think the two things that would dismay him the most, the first would be, he'd say we've lost a little bit about the art of discourse, that he'd be dismayed that we don't sit down with each other enough and really talk about our differences. We tend to highlight our differences more than look at our commonalities and where we're coming from. In his mind, we all start out with the same belief that we're here for education, that we're here for the students. And he would be dismayed that we jump to opposite sides so fast. He'd be a little dismayed that we argue about what's more important, the sciences or business or classics. I think the other thing he'd be a little dismayed about is he really wanted students to understand their importance in society when they left here, that they were the key to what he called the continuation of civilization. The university was here before, the university will be here later, and our job is to emphasize to students they play a role in changing in the entire society. And we've almost become too focused on, because of very real issues about it's expensive to go to college, students are really interested in what is their job, and he would agree with that. But he'd say, let's take a step back, and the next generation starts right here. Let's talk about that a little bit more.
One of the wonderful things about the university is that sentiment is expressed at every commencement ceremony in the Norland Charge.
Yeah, and that's a great story in and of itself, Norland's Charge. Norland's Charge was written in 1937 after he had come back from Germany while we were getting ready for really ramping up towards World War II. Norland's Charge comes at the very end of an essay that he wrote. And right before that Norland's Charge that we read today, he talks about his concern, his fear, and his hope for the next generation. And he basically is saying, graduates that are sitting here right now, we're going to rely on you. You are going to have to make the decisions in the future every day. What's of value to you? You're the ones who are going to have to decide what's right, what's wrong. You're the ones who are going to be our hope. He's really hoping in Norland's Charge that they will remember a little bit about what the university taught them, that they'll bring that with them. And as they're thinking about, what should I do? What should I stand up for? What's important? They'll remember voices like his that they heard in the classroom saying, we can work together, we can get this out. So you place Norland's Charge originally right at the front, right as we're getting ready to enter World War II, and you hear Norland's New Orleans hope for the future. Over time, we read that whatever decade we're in, whatever year those graduates are going out to, it's still that hope of the university to say, we hope that you'll remember what you learned in the classroom, that there's a voice. There is a professor's voice in the back of your head that is saying, remember what we taught you, make the right decision. You're the hope that we have to rely on. And it still resonates today. The circumstances can be different, but the sentiment, it's right there today.
We talked a little before we started recording about how, despite the fact that he was president of the university for 30 years and he was a very active scholar and writer, it's been hard to piece together the New Orleans story. Tell us how you've been able to do that.
I was teaching a class in the history of the university, and I taught it to engineering and design students and history students, and we did it through the history of the buildings. And I was really curious at the time, even though I had been here over 10 years, I started to really wonder, what were the names on these buildings? Who were these people? And I was interested in the stories behind them. And George Norlin, we know about Norlin Library, Norlin Quad, I heard, knew about the KKK, and I said, I want to know more about this. And I talked to a friend of mine who was a librarian who was in charge of the archives. And I said, do we have anything about Norlin? And she was kind enough to take me down to the archives and said, these are all boxes of Norlin's papers and work that he did. And I started digging through it. And I found his original handwritten manuscripts to some of the essays I had been reading. And it was fascinating to see how he changed the language, went from one draft to another. And I found his family photo album that he kept while he was in Germany and stuff, and saw his family and started looking for, well, there must be a biography that somebody wrote on Norlin. He was on the international stage, and there wasn't one. There was a couple of stories that had been written about him while he was president. He started to write an autobiography, but stopped after his childhood. So there really wasn't something that you could go back and say, oh, I'm going to read three different biographies on George Norlin and sort of piece together the truth. And it became almost like a treasure hunt. You'd read an essay and then look at his family papers to see what was going on in his life at that time. What made him write that? And it's just been a fascinating journey the more that I've learned. And I go back and I now teach it as a whole unit in my class and see others get excited about it. But there's a whole history there that we get to piece together about what was happening in the 20s during the KKK or the 30s in Berlin while he was there. And it really is a fascinating journey to piece together writings, family history, look at what other people are saying. And I just found it's one of the true joys that you get to be as a scholar and go search and spend hours looking through the library to find things about him. But he's just a fascinating person to get to know.
You've been having some early discussions about how to weave the traditions of the university and the university's values into how we do things today and in the future. Tell us a little bit about that.
The history of the university is sprinkled with notable people all through it. It really is a reflection of the city, of the state. And if you go back to the early part of the history and you see the significance of where Norlin Quad is now, the original part, and I should say that where Norlin Quad is today was the back of the university. The original university actually faces Boulder. So the original buildings today, we use the back doors. The front doors all face what we would say is the wrong way today. But the original bridge that goes over Varsity Lake was a very important thing of the students walking there to class. The road that now leads in front of Old Main, where when President Grant, right after he finished his presidency, came up in his carriage on that road and Jane Sewell, a daughter of President Sewell, bounded down the steps and jumped into the carriage to greet him while Ann Sewell was running out going, you know, just horrified. You know, but these areas on campus, the western edge of the lawn by Old Main, where the original lawn for graduations was, these traditions of where areas in the campus really were notable for, they meant something year after year. We can bring these back. We have a living museum here that goes back almost 150 years. Even when you walk through the science areas, the role that CU played in the early space development, in nuclear physics, all of these buildings really are traditions that we have in different parts. Walking around this campus means something. Even places like the UMC Fountain, Trumbo Fountain, these are places that historically meant a lot to the university that we've begun to forget a little bit over time, that they were really places where we discussed, we argued about the role of the country in things like Vietnam. We need to go back to using some of these places of traditions of discourse. They don't all have to be hostile, but they're places on this campus that are very important. We don't have to go back to the old traditions of first-year students wearing little hats. We don't have to go back to that. We don't have to go back to some of those traditions. But there really are some special traditions of places of welcoming into the campus that it's time we can go back and remember that.
Do you find that when students and even faculty hear these stories, they have an appreciation for those traditions?
They do. I've found that people really get excited about that. And I get the same response all the time when I talk about this. Even people that have been here 20, 30 years, and they'll say, I just didn't know that. And especially people who've been here, say, less than 10 years, they really don't know much about the history. And they get so excited that of feeling like they're a part of something they never knew existed. And so there's a lot of talks on campus about how do we bring these traditions back? How do we make these places important again? And how do we make students feel like they're now part of this tradition?
Well, it's a fascinating story of a great university, and we're grateful that a faculty member such as yourself is able to mine these stories and to convey them.
Well, it's a fascinating thing. It's something that turned from a minor interest to a real passion for me, and I'm just excited that I get to get other people excited about it and be a part of the history that we have here.
Thank you so much for sharing your insight and your stories with us today. I'm sure our listeners will be as fascinated as we were.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us for CU on the Air. The University of Colorado comprises four campuses, Boulder, Colorado Springs, Denver, and the CU Anschutz Medical Campus in Aurora. To learn more about CU, go to www.cu.edu. Thanks to our producer, Kathy Buten, and audio engineer, John Arnold. I'm Ken McConnellog, and we'll see you on the air next month.
University of Colorado.